today on EdgeFX.
So I started with this feeling, really, that in places that had been shaped by flight from slavery or marinage, that I might be able to find lessons for building a world without police today.
Elijah Levine at the University of Wisconsin-Madison speaks with Dr. Celeste Winston, an assistant professor of geography and urban studies at Temple University. She discusses her new book, How to Lose the Hounds, Maroon Geographies and a World Beyond Policing.
Okay, well, hey, everyone. It's a pleasure to have Professor Celeste Winston with us today to talk about her new book, How to Lose the Hounds, Maroon Geographies and a World Beyond Policing, which was a pleasure and I think an engaging sort of experience to read. So I really look forward to asking you some questions and to talking, not just about these like specific communities that you worked with and that that you sort of did archival work around, but also like the implications for a larger discussion about abolition that I think is like the intervention that you're really tactfully making. So in short, right, How to Lose the Hounds suggests that histories of Black marinage articulate persistent challenges to racist policing and alternative modes of social organization that form and are formed by maroon geographies or spaces of flight and placemaking in the midst of anti-Black state violence and extra state violence at sometimes. This history eschews the dynamic of institutional reform that dominates mainstream debates and might expand our cultural imaginary as we improvise the parameters of a world without policing. So I wanted to begin with a question about the product as a whole. I'm always interested in like, what is the sort of timeline or the evolution of coming to how a project ends up in a form? And considering How to Lose the Hounds brings together so many different disciplines and methodologies, geography, in some cases, ideas like cultural and folklore studies, right? And then like a specific history of these communities in Montgomery County. How did you encounter these communities? And when did you know this was going to be a book? And finally, I think this is sort of a second part of the question, because the ambitions of the project are certainly beyond the book and beyond the academy, what other forms than like this book manuscript might serve other parts of this project's aims?
Yeah. So first, thank you, Elijah, for that beautiful summary of my book. I wish that you wrote the back cover description. That sounds better than the way I put it. I really appreciate being in conversation with you and that you took the time to engage with this work. And in response to the first part of your question, how did I encounter these communities? So I started with this feeling, really, that in places that had been shaped by flight from slavery or marinage, that I might be able to find lessons for building a world without police today. And so that feeling was generated from some work that I had done in graduate school. Specifically, I had read Cedric Robinson's Black Marxism, right, who argues that we really should take seriously marinage as an ongoing Black radical tradition. And then I was also reading after that, Freedom as Marinage by Neil Roberts, who argues that scholars should reorient our epistemology of freedom around marinage. And so I was reading these books together in 2015, and I was doing an independent study with my advisor, Ruth Wilson Gilmore. And so we were talking a lot about, you know, these things, and I'm also was holding a lot of these questions around what safety beyond policing should look like. Because at the time I was working with the Black Alliance for Just Immigration in New York, I was living in New York and going to the CUNY Graduate Center. And the year before in 2014, then Police Commissioner Bill Bratton, you know, the commissioner of the NYPD, had called for the need for 1,000, at least 1,000 more police officers to the NYPD. And that had followed just some months after Eric Garner was killed by NYPD officers. So I was thinking a lot about calls for safety beyond policing and also holding this kind of imperative to take seriously marinage as this ongoing kind of abolitionist tradition and struggle and even intellectual project. And so that's really how the kind of question came together and that kind of feeling, which then took me to the archives in Montgomery County, Maryland. And so I had known that I wanted to do research somewhere close to home. I'm from the DC area and I have family.
Where exactly?
I grew up in Springfield, Virginia.
Okay. Yeah. So I was born in New York outside the city, but like grew up partially in Fairfax County.
Oh, okay.
And so like I know Montgomery County. And so this was like also doubly exciting for that reason.
But, wow, yeah. That's so cool. Yeah. I grew up in Fairfax County. Nice.
Yeah, my grandparents lived in Springfield.
Okay.
Yeah,
like wow.
Right across from Hayfield. Yeah.
Okay. Wow. Yeah. My uncle went to Hayfield. This is wild.
Yeah.
All these connections. So yeah, I knew I wanted to go close to home. You know, part of that was because, you know, research is such an extractive process. So I wanted to have some kind of tie to the place that I was doing research so that there would be some kind of built-in way for me to just situate myself and come back to that place and not just leave it after the research. And so I found myself in these archives in Montgomery County. Montgomery County, as I write about in the book, has this really, you know, long history of Black flight from slavery. Part of it is tied to the Underground Railroad running through Maryland and you know, in DC. And then also there were over 40 Black communities, in fact, that were established by Black people who had either been emancipated from slavery or who self-emancipated themselves, and descendants of Black people who had been enslaved. And so these communities, you know, have these deep histories, and they gave me such an opening to be able to look for connections between marinage and ongoing safety beyond policing. And so it was in 2017 that I first went to the archives in Montgomery County, and I was really just practicing. I had never been in archives before to do research at that level. And so I was just kind of testing the waters. And then I found so much there. It was over a summer, you know, between going back to New York, and I said, okay, this is it. I know this is where I'm going to stay to do this work. And so I did the research. I wrote this was my dissertation work. And then I was really fortunate to have Catherine McKittrick on my dissertation committee, my advisor, Ruth Wilson Gilmore, and together they are part of the Aaron Trees book series at Duke University Press. Catherine McKittrick is one of the editors. Ruthie is an advisor on the advisory board. And so they invited me to submit a proposal when I did my dissertation defense. So I'm so fortunate. This Aaron Tree series is a beautiful series that's really about rebellious methodologies, rude scholarship. And that was kind of like this guiding light as I was writing the book, knowing, you know, that is where I was going to be aiming to publish.
Yeah. One, like that sort of invitation to submit, thank you for like taking up the invitation. But also I think like as someone who engages, you know, a scant to geography sometimes in a sort of cultural and literary studies, like my encounter with McKittrick and Gilmore shaped my entrance into this book, especially because I think some of their concepts methodologically and then sort of spatially are like really helpful and like come through, I think, in a really clear and also careful and also like innovative way. That I just wanted to point out.
Yeah, thank you for pointing that out. Yeah, I feel so fortunate that has been my kind of home in geography, like being able to do scholarship in ways that counter some of the norms of, you know, scholarly production in ways that are still rigorous, but also really creative and even, you know, transformative. And we'll talk about more of that later. But I do want to answer the last part of your question around, you know, what other forms beyond the manuscript this project has taken and I hope to take. Part of it is doing, you know, having conversations like these, because I know this, you know, work just living on a page is not enough. And so I'm trying to breathe life into this work, having conversations with people. I've also been really intentional about doing book talks, not just in the university setting, but I've gone to, you know, community-based bookstores. Tomorrow, actually, I'll be going to North Carolina, to Chapel Hill and doing a talk at the Epilogue bookstore and cafe down there. So being able to have conversations with people who are on the ground, organizing, thinking through these kinds of questions, and directly connecting some of the examples of abolitionist life and placemaking in my book to work that they're doing has been really important and inspiring for me, and makes me feel like this project is doing some good.
That sort of comes through in your engagement, also like in the challenge that this book presents to like various sets of readers, right? Whether that's academic readers, whether it's policy readers, whether it's people reading for different reasons. But I think it does this through sort of carefully elucidating a set of concepts that allow you to traverse the like spatial, the policy, and then maybe we can call it like the sort of imaginary or the potential, right? Like, and I think this initially comes through in your definition and working of the term maroon geographies, which early on you define as, quote, constituting part of a Black placemaking tradition shaped by subversions and rejections of dominant spatial imaginaries, in addition to assertions of life-affirming forms of communities. And that this, right, that a spatial practice is also an epistemological practice, that sort of a communal practice is also one that potentially engenders different subjectivities. And so this, you know, this analysis of maroon geographies in Montgomery County, in particular, ties historical practices of marinage and flight from enslavement to contemporary modes of resistance to anti-Black policing and alternative modes of social organization. You undergird this move by adeptly emphasizing the historical intertwinement of enslavement and policing, and thus flight from slavery and resistance to policing. Flight from slavery also already implied breaking the law, and breaking the law could imply conscription into slavery. How do these historical resonances shape maroon geographies? And in particular, how do you balance these historical resonances with the material particularities of a particular era, right? You're traversing kind of the antebellum era, the postbellum era, Jim Crow, sort of post-civil rights, neoliberal economic restructuring and revanchism in the 1970s. And so all of these seem to be connected through your analysis of the maroon geographies. Methodologically, how do you sort of see that working?
Yeah, definitely. So one of the interventions I'm making, giving name to maroon geographies, is to highlight that marinage isn't just a form of flight, but is also deeply a practice of placemaking. And because of that, there are these kind of material legacies that continue to shape places that once were characterized by Black flight from slavery, or other kinds of Black freedom projects that maybe weren't even directly tied to flight from slavery, but are connected in the sense of fugitivity and the kind of freedom dreams that are inherent in those struggles. And so the way that I'm able to traverse so much time in my book is rooted in that understanding that marinage, right, is making place and you know, it's not just taking place, you know, in a really kind of ephemeral sense. And I actually had a historian read a draft of my manuscript who asked me a really important question that makes me smile always because, you know, it's very much a historian's question. And it was, you know, how can you jump so much time in your work? You know, are you making these arguments about, you know, causality? You know, what kind of historical continuity, you know, are you trying to point towards here? And that's really where the kind of rebellious methodology comes in to my work. You know, I'm able to jump from, you know, 1845 to 1972 and then, you know, go up into the 90s and then go back in time because I am not arguing for this kind of causal relationship. I don't have to just exhaustively account for, you know, historical continuity or causality, but instead I'm pointing us towards these material manifestations of Black people's flight from slavery and other forms of racial violence as a way to draw connections across time. And so there are these, you know, there end up being these really multi-generational infrastructures whereby residents in Montgomery County, Maryland, and we can say other Maroon geographies as well, are able to just continuously disrupt power relations and structures like those of policing and really literally, you know, form the grounds for some, you know, continued anti-racist work across time.
Yeah, I mean, that's a, I think it's a great insight and like that you're, especially in like the first chapter on Maroon folklore, right? You point to these methods of, yeah, intergenerationally sort of passing down and nurturing and also adapting, right? And also sometimes challenging modes of continuing to like make space. And you use this, this comparison between, what is it, holding ground and standing ground, right? And that like standing ground being this sort of dominant mode of sort of externalizing a relationship to place and in this other way, sort of atomizing a possessive logic that enables policing, right? And that holding ground is something that, you know, is practiced in 1845 and also is practiced in 1972, right? I think similarly, right, this method of highlighting these resonances and also sort of archivally rendering from the archive these ways that these practices are passed down points to the role that spatial organization plays in forming modes of subjectivity. For instance, a geography erected to support racialized capitalist social control uses police departments, immigration detention centers, surveilled housing for poor people, suburbs conspicuously absent of the marks of violent policing needed to maintain them, right? To define concepts like freedom, like property, and like safety in their own terms. Alternatively, Black Maroon geographies have historically constructed alternative spaces where state institutions are either absent or repurposed, supporting radically different ways of knowing the self in relation to others and society. What are the affordances and limits of this materialist mode of thought? Do Maroon geographies also potentially challenge the idea that material spaces form ideas and subjectivities in their image? And if so, how do they do that?
Yeah. So I really like this question. I have not been asked this question. And I, you know, been thinking about it. And something that it took me back to is this moment in graduate school where like a class of us students were asked, what is geography? And I remember saying something like, human geography is the study of how we make ourselves by making the world. And I think going back to that definition helps to get at the fact that there is a really significant relationship between ourselves, our communities, our societies, and the places that we're embedded in. And so, yeah, there is so much about the ideas and subjectivities that we have that are deeply informed and shaped by the material spaces that we inhabit. And I think there's so much afforded by thinking about space in our material world in that way. And I use the language of fugitive infrastructure, building from Deborah Cohen's work in my book, to highlight this kind of relationship between, you know, subjectivity and organizing in places. So Deborah Cohen defines fugitive infrastructure as the kind of material arrangements that accumulate by people's just daily efforts to survive when survival seems almost impossible. And so I apply that to understanding the work that residents in these historically Black communities or these maroon geographies in Montgomery County, Maryland are doing to adapt and react to oppressive structures in ways that sometimes are even criminal or criminalized, rather, these kind of methods to survive in the face of oppression. And I like the term infrastructure too here, because it highlights the fact that these acts are not individual or isolated, but they are equally as structural as the oppressive structures that they're resisting. And so that, right, really captures the kind of affordances, I think, that are created by the kind of materialist mode of thought that you're asking about. And at the same time, I think fugitive infrastructure invites us to understand that there is a kind of flexibility or a kind of fugitivity still inherent in the kind of structure that is inhering from people's survival efforts in places like these Black communities in Montgomery County. And so people's ideas and decisions and subjectivities are shaped, but they're not constrained by the fugitive infrastructures that might organize their lives and animate the places that they're living. And so in this way, fugitive infrastructure really gives us a way to understand, again, that the fact and the way that people react to oppression is systematic, is structural, but at the same time is unbounded. And I write about the kind of infinite possibilities that can emerge from fugitive infrastructure. And if we tie that into the arguments I'm drawing in the book around police abolition and the work to build a world beyond policing, I think fugitive infrastructure helps us to understand, again, that people who are pushing back against police have these real systematic and structural ways to build a world beyond policing. And there are pieces already here that are already structural that exist of that future world beyond policing. And that there are these, you know, infinite iterations of, you know, life beyond policing, community beyond policing, other kinds of non-carceral institutions and practices that are continuously being generated and changed across time in order to account for the ways that policing and the relationship of the state is constantly shifting as well in relation to these communities.
Yeah, I think that makes a lot of sense and was really helpful and made me think of something else that I hadn't originally thought of, but I sort of wonder about this book's sort of relationship to broader abolition struggles and also to a sort of materialist critique of sort of late capitalist labor relations and formations of like surplus populations. And you do engage with terms like geographic refuse and like the way that sort of the state and economic arrangements or political economy sort of creates a surplus population that it polices as well, but that there are sort of these theories of the indeterminacy or the potential indeterminacy in surplus social forms that are engendered by capitalism, which is to say, like, It seems like your engagement with fugitive infrastructures points to the way that there are sort of improvised modes of socialization in the wake of and against overwhelming state violence. And that there are all these debates happening about like, okay, what is the way that the sort of society to come will organize itself? Will it be spontaneous? Will it be by this program? Will it be by this program? And they're often, you know, these sort of theories that put this agency in a sort of yet to come organization of different thinking and speaking and socializing faculties that I think your book is providing a clear like historical rejoinder to, right? That is saying this isn't actually simply a matter of a totally new formation that will have to be sort of thought with no sort of prerequisite. But I wonder, had you thought about engaging with those kind of broader social theories?
Yeah. I, in the book, touch on some of the more dominant arguments about police abolition in ways that kind of push back against some of the locations or frameworks with which people are imagining a world beyond police. So one of those being that suburbs are a great model for police abolition. And you already highlighted that earlier in our conversation today, that the language, the understanding, the practice of safety in a suburb is actually completely rooted in the violent exclusion and policing of some people who are seen as not belonging in those places. And so, you know, should we be turning to suburbs really as models? And then I write in the book as well, more generally, that we don't have to imagine abolition or world beyond policing from scratch. It's not just this kind of abstract imaginative project, but that there is evidence really written into our world. There's evidence in the archives. There's evidence if we talk to people. We can even look to our own experiences, many of us, and think about, you know, times where we didn't call the police and what did we do instead? What kind of relationships that we already practice that are already parts of the world without police that we are envisioning? So yeah, the book really is about helping people to ground future visions for a world beyond policing within the present and the past, and specifically highlighting the places, these Black communities that have been subjected to some of the most brutal excesses of police violence, right, as actually central models for a world beyond policing. Because I know in conversations I've had with people, they'll often, you know, question if, you know, Black community, in particular Black communities and cities, can offer us any lessons, because that is where policing is so heavily concentrated. And I think turning exactly to those places is where so many lessons exist, because you have these direct confrontations with policing, you have these transformations of policing institutions and practices in really surprising ways. And that is where we can then take and build up and learn how we might be able to apply those kinds of practices to other places.
Yeah, and even while I think that point about, right, the encounter and the historical the historical sort of lessons to like ground a present engagement with the world without policing shows up also in your engagement with how often in these communities in Montgomery County and also more broadly, it's not been sort of simply a matter of like flight from and divestment from state power and policing, but also an engagement with collaboration or with sort of an uneven adoption of the state's logic of policing. This is especially present in chapters 3, 4, and 5. And you talk about an example that I'm thinking of that I think was especially sort of helpful for me was this example of Carolyn Twyman and the legal and civic response to this police chase, which you talk about as jumping scales, you call it, and this just like the a maroon troop that you compare it to in 1845, that these like spatial maneuvers of flight from policing sort of denaturalize a landscape by sort of demonstrating the superfluity of these like methods of control, and in one instance, sort of Twyman's case jumps scales, as you say, and like brings this question to spheres of discourse that otherwise sort of may not have paid attention, but also that in this same moment, right, we get a response that is, as you point out, right, the sort of advisory council, or like the commission to like oversee and investigate thoroughly the like potential misconduct and sort of shore up its own legitimacy again. And so you're engaging with this long history of criticism of the state and debate about how revolutionary movements should approach the institutions they aim to abolish. And ultimately, you are departing from, you know, potentially anarchist position vis-a-vis the state, recognizing the possibilities of refiguring dominant institutions in a new image by interrupting their material and ideological forces. Rather than proposing a totalizing framework, this requires improvisatory engagement with Black epistemologies that precede new state formations, as well as a nuanced attention to how power morphs and presents what you call reformist reforms. I think that's Dr. Gilmore's term, reformist reforms,
yes,
to shore up its legitimacy. How do the communities and activist organizations you engage navigate this dynamic differently? What general examples and warnings do they pose for abolition more generally?
I really appreciate you bringing up the Carolyn Twyman story, because, you know, Carolyn Twyman, she's a resident of the neighborhood of Tobytown, for those listening in who may not have read the book. She had been pulled over by police officers in 1972, and she refused to sign the ticket, and she fled. And she was ultimately killed in a car chase. And so I write about that moment in the book as both this like way to center this Black woman's experience and the pain and violence that she faced, not just in that moment, but across her relationship with police in the county, in Montgomery County, and also highlight how her moment of flight beyond policing is tied to a long history of Black flight from policing. Going, you know, I link it to a story that you mentioned, Elijah, in 1845. Of 40 Maroons who had fled from police along the same road that Carolyn Twyman took. And then I also connect these stories to the ways that Carolyn Twyman's community members in Tobytown are pushing back against police and even fleeing from police, but also holding ground at the same time, trying to counteract the ideas inherent in urban renewal policy and practice that mandate that to make a place developed, to bring life to a place, requires that the, you know, Black residents who are working class and who have been living in those places all along have to be pushed out, and have to, or the ones who might stay, you know, challenging the idea that they have to live differently and have different kinds of relationships to their land and their community. So there's all kinds of flight from policing that takes place at the same time that people are directly encountering the state. And so I spend time through the book, you know, playing with the relationships that Black members of these historically Black communities in Montgomery County have with the state. And I use this term of strategic entanglements to give name to the ways that people living in these communities are working with the state in sometimes contradictory ways, but still with the ultimate goal of transforming the role of the state in replicating racial violence and reproducing it for the sake of racial capitalist development and property. And so one of the periods that I highlight around the kind of strategic entanglements that residents in Montgomery have with policing in particular is through the war on drugs through the 70s into the 90s, where residents like you know, Black folks throughout the country at the time were increasingly turning to police as one solution to combating drug use and sales in their communities. And so in Lincoln Park, one of the neighborhoods where I did research, there was a group of residents who partnered with the local police department to do these marches, trying to kind of shift the locations of people who might be selling drugs in the neighborhood to like make sure they never had a chance to even complete a sale because they were just considered to just, you know, be constantly moving. Or there was the case of another neighborhood called Scotland, which participated in this state-based program in Maryland to evict tenants who were found guilty of drug violations. And so there are these real relationships that residents are building with police, but at the same time, residents are still prioritizing their own goals for community and for supporting each other over arrest and punishment. So the marches, for example, that Lincoln Park residents made with police officers was, again, about shifting the kind of geography of drug sales so that it could never be finished, right? So a sale could never be finished rather than finding people and, you know, arresting them and punishing them for selling drugs. Also at the time throughout the 70s and 90s, as well as throughout the history of these communities, there have been these visions and strategies of meeting people's needs in the here and now, from just doing programs that support people who might need help with paying for necessities in their homes or providing free educational services, things that are all about and all a part of the kind of visions for safety beyond policing that people today are calling for. So there is this, again, this kind of entanglement, but it's strategic. And there's a kind of transformation that is happening simultaneously wherein residents are able to, you know, not just extend the violence and systems of the state, but kind of use them to their benefit. One of my favorite examples of this was a story in 2012 when residents in Lincoln Park got a police substation in their neighborhood converted into a tutoring and mentoring space. And so I talk about that and how that is an example of really community beyond policing, because police were pulled out of the neighborhood and it wasn't community policing where, you know, police would be the people tutoring and mentoring. At the same time, though, there was this, you know, bolstering of police infrastructure right outside of the neighborhood in Rockville City proper, where Lincoln Park is situated. And so in 2012, there was a new police headquarters that opened up. So, you know, part of why the substation was able to be converted was that the police didn't need that space anymore. So there are these, you know, these really interesting moments to be able to zoom in on and look at the kinds of transformations that are happening, but also really take seriously the kinds of contradictions and limitations of negotiations with the state as well, right? Because all of these aren't perfect negotiations, but they do remind us that abolition is a process of transformation. It's not something that's attained at once. And these moments also invite us to look at really who might be being left behind Right. And some of these struggles towards building a world beyond police or practicing safety without police so that we might do these kinds of negotiations differently. And I'll say one more thing about these strategic entanglements, and that's that just like, you know, the book is always kind of going back and forth through time, I write about how strategic entanglements have always been a part of Maroon geography since the era of slavery. And that ranges from the kind of treaties that Maroon societies might make with the states around them, where they might even agree to turn back other freedom seekers in exchange for official recognition as a free, you know, removed from the slave society community, all the way to even individual decisions, maybe leave behind a mother and her children who were enslaved because of the gendered, you know, dynamics of labor on plantations and also the labor of social reproduction. And those kinds of strategic entanglements still exist today as part of Maroon geographies. And again, they are, they have some limitations, but they're also opportunities to be able to really figure out what kind of improvisation is going to happen. And as we try to build a world without police.
Yeah, I mean, I think especially as, you know, as sort of a like literary studies scholar, I'm certainly attuned to the helpfulness of like the archetype of either the complete fugitive or like the complete state agent, right? But like, and they maybe are helpful in sort of culling these discursive communities. But also, I think as you're pointing out, right, there these histories of engagement and these ambivalent moments. And I remember encountering James Forman's book that you cite and like thinking about how this history is not this uninterrupted process and sort of neither of these like poles of complete withdrawal or complete sort of assimilation. I think we're getting near time, but I do have one last question about kind of the stakes and implications on a broader level. In the last section, you do turn towards the sort of already latent possibility of what you call a global abolition project, which recognizes and builds upon persistent challenges to the modern global police regime that reverberates with racial logics underpinning histories of both slavery and colonialism, as you write in your conclusion. As regimes worldwide employ police power to subjugate, constrict, and systematically kill populations globally, those same regimes' vacuous neoliberal rhetoric of democracy and human rights struggle to reassert their law and order that they are based upon. The violent methods of global policing are more and more becoming indistinguishable from the results of those methods. Virtual solidarities that ensue from racial capitalism's internal contradictions need to be actualized. How can, and this is the big question, and like, you don't need to have the answer, but how can we nurture, and you borrow Julia Scott's term, common wind, how can we nurture that common wind?
Yeah. So I'll use center the example of Black American and Palestinian solidarity, you know, just because that's been on my mind a lot. And I think this is a really great example of the kind of common wins that we could nurture. So, you know, if we think about even just the past 10 years of organizing against police violence in both the US and in Palestine, there are some really amazing solidarities that have been built. So, for example, in the wake of the police killing of Michael Brown in 2014, and then again in 2020 after police killed George Floyd and Breonna Taylor, Palestinians took to social media to share tips for treating tear gas to help support protesters here in the US. And their kind of solidarity was rooted in part in an understanding of the exchange of policing tactics and technologies and weapons between the US and Israel, right? So in Israel, actually, the government uses US-made tear gas canisters against Palestinians and their occupation of the West Bank and in their war making in Gaza. And so the kind of knowledge of that, coupled with the fact that Israeli surveillance technologies are also used and imported back into the United States. And again, there are all kinds of exchange programs between police departments in these two countries. That knowledge forms the basis for a kind of organizing that is rooted in the material connections, bringing people, Black Palestinians Black people and Palestinians, and then of course there are Black Palestinians as well, right? To work together and imagine and literally fight for a world beyond policing. And this kind of solidarity isn't new. If we think back to the Black Panther Party, they organized demonstrations in support of Palestine. Right, they had all kinds of critiques of the ways that the U.S. is implicated and invested and a beneficiary of imperialism in Israel and war making in Israel. And so, so I think that's a really great way to think about how we can nurture the common wind is rooting our understanding of the ways that policing is conducted on this global scale and is literally route with all kinds of exchange programs and weapons sharing, and that our organizing against policing should also exist on a global scale. And we already have a blueprint for how to even draw connections because the police are already doing that.
Yeah, thank you for making that connection. And thank you also for writing this book and speaking with me and thinking with me. It was a pleasure. I hope you all have a good day.
Thank you.
That was Elijah Levine in conversation with Celeste Winston. You've been listening to EdgeFX, a production of CHE, the Center for Culture, History, and Environment and the Nelson Institute for Environmental Studies at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. This episode was produced by Kristen Billings and me, Tessa Archambault. The music you're hearing is by Julian Lynch. You can get all of our episodes sent straight to your computer or mobile device by subscribing to EdgeFX wherever you get your podcasts. If you like the show, please leave us a rating and a review or tell a friend about it. That really helps connect us with new listeners. You can follow us on Twitter @EdgeFXMeg or find us online at edgefx.net.